Hi, welcome to Female Trouble. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a podcast spotlighting women in Baltimore. For Maria Thompson, education is the family business. With a background in textiles, Maria has worked as an administrator at Tennessee State University and served as provost and vice president for academic affairs at SUNY Oneonta. In July 2015, Maria became president of Coppin State University, a historically Black institution in West Baltimore with a history of educating nurses, teachers, and other professionals. Coppin has struggled with financial problems and poor graduation rates, and Maria talked about taking on that challenge. She also discussed representation, becoming Coppin's president in the wake of the Baltimore unrest, and drawing inspiration from the university's namesake. Here's our conversation. Where are you from originally?
Nashville, Tennessee.
What was growing up in Nashville like?
Well, seeing as it's my hometown, I can kind of contrast it from what it's like now. And of course, I was a child and had a different perspective, but it was very quiet, a nice place, I think, for families. My mom and father built a house out in the suburbs, and we lived out in the suburbs. And now Nashville has grown so much. Every time I go to visit my mother, it's like no suburbs left anymore. The town is just taken over. It's grown like a weed.
What kinds of things did you do as a kid and in the suburbs? Did you have the typical kind of suburban childhood?
Probably. Playing with neighbors, big lawns to run through, quiet summers where you would swim in the neighborhood pool at the YMCA, catching lightning bugs in the evening and just having fun. And of course, always keeping up your studies. Reading and arithmetic seem to always be constant companions for us because both of my parents were educators.
What did they teach?
My mother she's retired. She taught Spanish and English, and my father taught science courses, especially physics and earth science.
Were they ever your teachers?
No. They never taught me. They taught two of my two younger sisters, and then my father taught my father taught my younger sister, and my father and my mother taught one of my oldest sisters. But I never had either of them.
How did you feel about that?
Now I'm kind of jealous. At the time, I was happy not to have them because they were pretty strict.
So education was very important to your family growing up?
Yes, it's the family business.
Yes. Did you always envision yourself ending up in education?
Yes and no. I mean, in some shape, form, or fashion, whether it was formal or informal education setting, I thought about it, but it's kind of natural. It's the kind of natural thing for me to do after having two parents who were teachers. And my eldest sister, who just retired, is a professor at the College of New Jersey in Trenton. So it's kind of the family business.
How many sisters do you have?
I have three sisters and one brother.
A lot of siblings.
Yes.
What was that like?
Oh, gosh, great. They are still my closest friends. And we, even though now we're all adults, we fall back into childhood when we're together, and it's really enjoyable.
Yeah. What was your, like, sibling identity? You know, sometimes there's the bossy one, the nice one, the mean one. Were you any of those kind of sibling types?
Well, I'm the middle child and the peacemaker and the person who was the bridge between my two oldest sisters and my younger brother and younger sister. So I was kind of the peacemaker or the bridge for the family. And I still serve that role.
So you stayed in Tennessee for college, right?
For undergrad, correct.
For undergrad. Why did you decide to stay there and to go to Tennessee State? And did you ever want to leave where you came from?
Well, of course I thought about leaving as a high school senior, everybody's talking about where they're going, and many people stayed locally or in the state of Tennessee, and others, of course, went across the nation. And you do give it some thought about, should I leave? Should I stay? But I'm third generation. My siblings and I are third generation to attend Tennessee State University. So, I mean, it was actually, looking back, I'm glad I did, because you don't have a lot of families, especially African-American families, that have that many generations at one university. So I'm glad that I did.
Well, even that many generations attending college, right? If you're third generation, I mean, education goes back far in your family, it sounds like.
Yes, it does. And my niece, my brother's daughter, one of my brother's daughters, is attending Tennessee State University as the fourth generation.
That must be, you know, you gotta carry the torch, right?
Absolutely. There's a lot of pressure on her.
So what did you study as an undergrad?
Textiles. Yeah, textiles in undergrad. And then in my master's degree, I did more, but as I went further into it, I became more interested in the science of it. At first, it was just kind of like a general study of textiles because, you know, a textiles tells you a lot about a society, its technology, its aesthetic. So a lot of general study at the undergraduate level, but I have a deep interest in science of all kinds. And so as I got further into my studies, I got more into the science of textiles. And then eventually in my PhD program, I added even the economics of textiles and, you know, how much of the economy, and especially in the South, and especially historically, evolved around textiles. So it's an interest of mine that I haven't really delved in years because I've been an administrator for quite a while now. But actually in retirement, I plan to start thinking about it again and do some traveling, going to different textile museums and exhibits and do more reading, maybe even take up weaving or something that I've never really done in the textile
field. Where does that interest come from? Do you remember when you were young? Because that's pretty unique to study textiles that intensely.
Yeah, it is unusual. Not that many people have studied it. It's not a really popular major then or now. If I have to really pinpoint it, I'm a tactile learner, and my mother used to sew and taught all of her daughters to sew. And so being able to take something that's one-dimensional and turn it into something three-dimensional made it very interesting for me. I would observe the textures, you know, whether it's woven, whether it's knitted, you know, what's the direction of the yarns. And it was a good combination to me of something that has some elements of being artistic and some elements of being scientific. And I think as a person, not as a professional maybe, but as a person, I probably live in the intersection of the artistic and the scientific. And so it was probably natural for me to select that.
Do you find any of those skills or qualities coming out in the work that you do now?
Yes, actually. Now that you have asked me that question, yes. I do a lot of public speaking. And there's an art to that, to storytelling, to reaching an audience with a message. There's some art to that for sure. But then there's a very technical part of my job where I use data extensively and study data and think about how do we further their institution and improve the student experience based on all the data gathering that goes on in universities these days. You can't be a university president these days and not have some level of data skills.
So how did you make the transition from your textile studies to working in education and administration?
Well, actually, I remember sitting at my desk as an assistant professor, thinking that I could serve more people and have more contact and a bigger impact if I got outside of my discipline, because there's only a limited number of students who are interested in any discipline. You know, you limit the number of students you come in contact with when you're within a discipline. And when you are in an administrative role, you get to touch many more students. And I wanted to have a broader impact. Even though I loved what I studied and I loved sharing that with students, I just felt that the student experience is bigger and broader than just in the classroom. And in some ways, I wouldn't say more important, but certainly just as important to be able to set the stage or the university setting where learning can take place inside and outside the classroom. I just wanted to have a broader impact on students, and limiting myself only to my discipline, I would only see a fraction of the students or impact a fraction of the students on a campus.
Did you have a positive experience when you were a student in undergrad and, you know, in all of your studies?
Oh, yes. I loved being a student. Which is probably why I still work in the university setting. I can't imagine anything better than waking up every day and just improving yourself and reading and getting to know more about the world. Being a student is fantastic. And you know, some people get caught up in being what we call professional students. They just graduate from one degree to the next, and just, it's their life. Now, and I can understand that, because it's a great thing.
What do you like to read? Do you have any favorite authors or the authors who have influenced you most?
You know, it's kind of changed since I got my Kindle. The Kindle has changed my relationship with the print matter.
It's still reading if it's on a Kindle, though.
It is, but I love the instant access, being able to just sit on the beach and download a book and just start reading it. I don't have to move other than my finger, you know, just and then you download the book. So what do I like? I like all sorts of things. And it depends on the time of year. Like, I'm really in a busy time of year right now, and I don't have a whole lot of time to read. I do most of my reading on an airplane for leisure or even for work. I spend a lot of time reading for work on an airplane, too. But it's funny that you mentioned this, because actually in the car on the way over, I was trying to catch a minute of some relaxation reading while we were in traffic. And I just started to download a book by Neil deGrasse Tyson. It's Astrophysics for People in a Hurry. So
that's fitting.
Yeah, very fitting. Yeah. So this weekend, I'll probably delve into that book.
So what brought you to Coppin? I mean, what attracted you to the job, and why come to Baltimore?
Well, believe it or not, my interview, there were multiple interviews, but one of them took place during the unrest. And people thought, why on earth would you be walking into that? Because that campus is right across the street from where all the unrest took place. Now, I was undaunted by that, because, you know, in human history, incidents like that can happen anywhere. And we've seen it since 2015. They've been happening all over the world. So you can't just judge a place, a community, based on that one event. But Coppin State University, in my opinion then, and even more so now that I've been there for 2 years, Coppin State University is the university of the future. And why do I say that? A, it's in an urban area, and the vast majority of Americans live in or near an urban area. B, we serve underrepresented first generation students. Most students in the future are going to be, because of demographic changes, it's going to be students who are either children of immigrants themselves to some extent, and black and brown students. So we've already been serving those students for the 117 years we've existed. And because of demographic changes also, students in college are becoming older. The average age on our campus is 26, 27, something like that. So we are the university of the future. We're urban. We're serving non-traditional population in some ways. And we are serving older students. So
I wanted to ask you about the unrest, because you officially started, I think, just a month or two after the unrest, right? And so, of course, you know, you were not part of shaping Coppin's mission before you were there. But, I mean, in what way do you think the unrest did influence Coppin and the work that Coppin does?
Well, actually, the kind of work that the campus has been involved in long before I got there has always been in community building and community engagement. So what the campus was doing long before the unrest were things to help mitigate situations such as that. And we continue to this day. It is just for a number of circumstances, a perfect storm, I guess you could say, things came together for that unrest to happen in that particular community at that particular time. But as I said earlier, you see that circumstances converge almost anywhere for those sorts of things to happen. But I'm proud to say that Coppin State University, before I got there and surely after I leave, will always be engaged in the community and community building and strengthening.
Well, you also came on at a challenging time for the university, and the school has, you know, struggled with enrollment, struggled with graduation rates. I know you've made enrollment a priority of yours, but tell me about, you know, coming on to a university that's facing some hard times and how you kind of steer it in the right direction.
Well, honestly, I like a challenge. I would be a little bored if I were at a place where people told me, okay, Maria, just hold the steering wheel for the next X number of years. That would not have been for me at all, because I like to be engaged in things that are growing. And as I said, Coppin State University represents the university of the future because of the population we serve and our location. So taking all of those things and seeing they're actually assets, we are having some success in changing the direction little by little of our enrollment. For instance, last year, our freshman class increased by 50%, 50. So that tells you that Coppin State University is a desirable place where students want to attend. And we have many natural assets that make it an attractive place. So I didn't see myself coming in at a bad time. I saw myself coming in at a good time. We have dedicated people who work there. It's in a great living, learning community, beautiful campus, absolutely gorgeous campus. And we have tons of data tools. As I was telling you earlier, you can't be a college president and be effective these days without data. And it's the campus that I've seen that has the richest number of data assets. So using those data assets and the energy and engagement of the employees and even the students in the community and other supporters, we've actually been having a good time working to increase the enrollment and do other things that make Coppin State all it should be.
I'm curious what your transition to Baltimore was like and what has, you know, surprised you about the city. I know Baltimore is very different than Oneonta. So can you tell me about some of those differences you've experienced?
First of all, thank God it's warmer.
Oh, yeah.
Here in Baltimore than it was in Oneonta. I loved Oneonta. It was a beautiful place. But it's probably snowing there now, where here it's 90 degrees. So, it snowed there for about, it seemed like to me, 6 months. It may have been only five, but what's the
only
difference?
Only five, yeah.
When you're from Nashville, what's the difference? But, and it's a college town. Like, they had 12,000 people. 6,000 of them were my students on campus. So it's purely a college town. And Baltimore is a real city, metropolitan area, kind of like, I mean, it's below the Mason-Dixon line, so I consider it the South, much more the South than living in Oneonta. So the transition was pretty easy, I believe. I love the fact that I don't have to wear a coat 6 months out of the year.
Yes. Yeah. I think whether or not you determine Maryland or Baltimore to be the South is entirely based on where you're from, in my experience. So if you're from the South, you think it's Southern. If I'm from the Midwest, I only ever thought of the state of Maryland growing up as very East Coast, very Northern. So I think it's just a matter of perspective, and you'll get 50-50 answers on that.
You're right. It does. Now, I think people that are from here don't consider it the South.
Yeah.
But if you come in from somewhere else, particularly the South, you see a lot of similarities. So you still kind of think of it that way.
Do you miss the South? Did you like growing up in the South?
Well, it was my home, and I sure enjoyed the big yards and, you know, big space, growing up with big spacious yards and the warm weather. Now, it got awfully hot, and it could be hot for a long time, but that's fine, because on New Year's Day it may be 75 degrees and you're wearing shorts, and that's great too. So, but sometimes in August it's unbearable.
Yeah. So you are the first female president of Coppin.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean to you, if anything? Not to, you know, put words in your mouth, but what is your experience being the first female president like?
Well, I tell you what makes it really meaningful for me. Not so much that the presidents who were installed before me were men. What makes it meaningful is that the institution is one of the few that's named after a woman and that's named after an African-American woman. And that's just like, oh, my God, beyond my wildest dreams. If I was a little girl, when I was a little girl, I never thought I would grow up to be a college president at a university where it is named after an African-American woman. And an African-American woman who actually was an educational pioneer. Her story is so inspiring. It inspires me in my job. Do you know much about Fannie Jackson Coppin?
I know she went to Oberlin, right, and became... I don't remember the whole story. I've heard bits and pieces.
Yes, yeah. You're correct. She did graduate from Oberlin. She was born in Washington, D.C., so kind of a local girl, not exactly, but in the area. She was born a slave. Her freedom was purchased by her aunts when she was 12. She moved to Rhode Island and Massachusetts as a teenager. Did domestic work, got some tutoring to some degree, was self-taught, went on to Oberlin and became the second African-American woman to obtain a bachelor's degree in the United States. And then she went on to become a school principal, the first African-American woman to be a school principal, and the first African-American, male or female, to be superintendent of a school district. And she got married to a man named Levi Coppin, who happened to be a pastor at one of the local churches that still stands, Bethel.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bethel AME Church. And so they got married. And then at some point, she left with him to go to South Africa and started their own school in South Africa. So.
A woman of many firsts.
Yeah. And so to be a college president at an institution named after Fanny Jackson Coppin, it doesn't get better than that for me.
You know, I ask a lot of guests about this, but you brought up, you know, when you were a little girl, never could you have dreamed of something like this. And I wonder about the importance of visibility to you. And, you know, I've talked with other women, whether they're in a punk band or a school administrator, about, you know, if you can't see it, you can't be it, that kind of thing. And how do you feel about that and the visibility of Black women in the roles of, you know, university president?
Yeah, that's a good one. You know, I'm an introvert, and I, you know, I could do my whole job if I could be effective, which I could not be. If I could be an effective college president by being under the radar, not coming to podcasts.
My apologies.
No, it's part of the job. Just being bookish and being behind the scenes, I would do it. And you will find that many people who are in positions that are very public don't necessarily want to be in the public eye, but because the work is so important to them that they just bite the bullet and do it. That's what I do. And I realize now it's probably important that I am more visible for anyone that I might inspire, whether that's an African-American woman or a person of any persuasion or gender, because you never know where your inspiration is going to come from. Because if you really connect with people as human beings, we all have, if we listen to each other's stories and if we are genuine with each other, you can, one heart always touches another. So you never know who you're going to, you know, inspire. But surely women, and surely African-American women, I guess I could inspire a younger generation. And so, yeah, visibility is important. And it's a personality thing. I'm just an introvert and I could stay under the radar. But for other people, I'm not just working for myself. I'm working for other people. So for the benefit of anybody I might even accidentally inspire, it's important to tell my story, to be visible, to in any way I can be a positive influence.
Do you have people like that in your life who have inspired you in that way?
Oh, wow. My mother, my father, my older sisters, my younger siblings, a lot of people, great faculty members, great professors when I was in undergrad and graduate school as well, and other colleagues.
So your whole career has not been at HBCUs, but you attended one and now you are the president of one. And I'm wondering what you think the role is, you know, of a university like Coppin or an HBCU in the larger community or, you know, in the city of Baltimore?
Well, I always find that an interesting question because why would there be a question about the role? And so when I get that question, it's like, well, why wouldn't there be a role? I mean, it's a institution of higher learning, a great history of education and community outreach. I mean, as long as there's human needs, there's need for education. And we are one of the 4,000 universities and colleges in the United States. And they're all needed because people have different preferences. People have different perspectives that they want to gain, you know, because education takes place in a context. Self-development takes place within a context, and we provide, I think, with our heritage, being in, you know, a Baltimore campus named after an African-American woman that's historically Black, we provide a rich context for education and self-discovery. So it's a strange question to me because it's like, why wouldn't we have a role? But
that makes sense. I guess when I think about the question, I'm coming more from a place of you know, the historical need for universities like that and how they came about in the first place, I guess, and kind of the historical context. But that makes sense.
Yes.
Do you consider yourself an ambitious person? And did you have any kind of, you know, plan laid out for yourself when you decided to work in administration and pursue education?
Good question again. So I think I am ambitious, but not in the way that I traditionally thought of ambition. Initially, as a child and being raised by modest parents and being raised to be a modest person, ambition was not something I thought of as a positive trait. But when the purpose of your life and your energy is not just for yourself, then it's good to have ambition. And that's what I share with my students often, that your education is not just for you. It's for others as well. And I can, by extension, say that to myself. My profession or my presidency is just not, surely, this job is definitely not just for myself. It's for other people. So, yes, when I think of it that way, I am ambitious because my energy goes toward, yes, you know, I do get a paycheck. Yes, I do have a position and a job, but my energy goes toward more uplifting other people than myself. And so I'm very ambitious when it comes to making sure my energy is used for the greater good.
I think that ambition being a dirty word thing is also incredibly gendered. I mean, you almost hear it used in a negative way about a man.
You're right.
That's all we can do. Shake our head and nod.
And young women need not be burdened with that. It is good to be ambitious, yes, for yourself and yes, for others.
Going back to what you tell your students about, you know, their education is to share. I mean, do you consider that a responsibility, and do you consider giving back and, you know, doing work that is larger than yourself a responsibility of yours?
I do, because I'm not going to be here forever in any role or on the earth, period. None of us are going to be here forever. So at some point in your life, and I don't know what point that was for me, but at some point in your life, you start to figure out that you are making sure that the world is going to be a better place once you leave, or that your institution or your whatever your place of work is going to be better once you leave. So you may not even reap the fruits. Like whatever legacy I leave for Coppin State may be 10 years away. I may be nowhere around to see what I hope are positive things, seeds I'm planting. So, yeah, and I think you have to instill that in people early, and that's why I tell the students your education is not just for yourself. Yes, we want you to graduate and go to graduate school or be an entrepreneur or get that high-paying job. Absolutely do that and do that for yourself. But a lot of people put you in college, and a lot of people help you in your career. So you're going to have to be the person that does that for somebody else eventually. And the sooner you start thinking that way, the better. And the more joy can come to you, because you're never going to be paid enough. You're never going to get the time back that you spend away from your family. So the time you spend at work, the time you spend at school needs to be something that plants the seed for the future.
What do you hope your legacy is?
Oh, boy. I just hope I leave every place better than I found it. And it's for others to determine that, whether that happened or not. I'm not going to try to judge it. I'm just going to, that is my intention when I use my energy.
President Thompson, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you. I appreciate it. She a dope girl, dope girl, dope girl. Dope, 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 dope girl. Dope, uh-huh, dope.
for listening to my conversation with Maria Thompson, president of Coffin State University. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a Baltimore Sun podcast. You can find Female Trouble everywhere you listen to podcasts, and as always, it would help us out if you subscribed and gave us a rating. We're also on Twitter at FMLTrouble and online at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble. Our theme song is Dope Girls by Shifty featuring TT the Artist. Thanks again, and we'll be back next week.